Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A lot of people in our culture are not used to cooking at home. They haven't been taught those skills. They're not familiar with it. And so we try to target that audience and say, okay, it's not that hard. Let's show you how to do it.
Kate Young teaches nutrition workshops at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. We sit in on one of her classes where students help cook and then help eat healthy dishes. Two stories from Harvest Public Media today. The FDA wants to create guidelines to prevent any possible terrorist attack on our food system. Then how Amish farmers are banding together to sell more of the food they grow. And St. Patrick's Day is coming up, so we corn beef brisket and another cut of beef that is maybe a little less traditional. The Week in Food News with Lou Ann Johnson.
To address diet-related health problems, the World Health Organization wants to lower the advised amount of daily sugar intake. The WHO is considering slashing previous recommendations in half, lowering one's daily calories in sugar from 10 to 5%. For someone with a normal BMI, the proposed guidelines would limit sugar intake to 25 grams, or 6 teaspoons, per day. Here's a reference point. A can of regular soda contains about 40 grams of sugar. Raw milk will not relieve some of the symptoms associated with lactose intolerance. That's according to a new study done by researchers at Stanford. But the study is being criticized by some, including the farmer who provided the raw milk for the study. Problem number one, finding participants who fit the clinical definition of lactose intolerance. Over 400 people applied to be part of the study, but of the 63 who were ultimately tested, only 27 were deemed lactose intolerant. 11 then dropped out of consideration when they learned they would have to drink milk over several weeks. That left only 16 people for researchers to observe. During the study, they drank raw milk, pasteurized milk, and soy milk exclusively over 8-day periods, separated by a week of zero milk consumption each time. They then reported their symptoms of physical discomfort. Results found no noticeable difference between the severity of lactose intolerance symptoms from raw milk compared to pasteurized milk. Another point of contention, perhaps the 8-day period of drinking raw milk was not long enough for bodies to adjust to the bacteria. That's the theory from Mark McAfee, owner of Organic Pastures and supplier of the raw milk for the study. Senior author Christopher Gardner says this is not intended to be the final word on the issue. And South by Southwest is underway in Austin, Texas. Between the concerts and TED Talks, there's a niche for foodies, too. Festival-goers can sample printed food like 3D-printed Oreos, and Cronuts made a high-profile appearance alongside famous Franklin Barbecue. Technology and food intermix at South by, with IBM's supercomputer Watson, showcased in the form of a food truck. Watson appeared on Jeopardy, beating contestants, and is now playing chef by indexing thousands of recipes and customizing them for visitors. See a photo of the Watson food truck on our website, along with other news stories, interviews, and recipes at eartheats.org.
Find us on Twitter to interact with Earth Eats throughout the week and get all the food farm news updates. Search for Earth Eats. Weekly news with Lou Ann Johnson. Thanks for all the work.
Till next time.
In the wake of September 11th, the U.S. government spent years and billions of dollars fortifying various industries against possible terrorist attacks. Now, the FDA is tackling the issue. The agency is currently crafting rules with the intent to strengthen vulnerable sections of the food system. But with few documented incidents of malicious contamination, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon considers whether the potential for food terrorism is fact or fiction.
It sounds like the premise of an action movie. And in 2005's Batman Begins, it kinda was, only the villain tainted the water supply instead of food. Scarecrow, played by Cillian Murphy, was poisoning the citizens of Gotham City through a broken pipe.
This is where we make the medicine.
The plot plot of this superhero blockbuster might not be so far off from a possible reality, at least if scenarios thought up by American regulators come true. Under new proposed rules from the FDA, food processors and manufacturers, both domestic and those abroad that ship food to the U.S., would need to take steps to mitigate a potential terrorist attack. FDA food safety expert Don Kramer says we haven't seen a large-scale attack on the food supply yet.
But it has happened on the small scale, and we've certainly studied it since 9/11 to assess what the potential impacts might be, and they can be catastrophic.
Catastrophic to either consumers or producers. The FDA rules focus on weak links in food processing in an attempt to ferret out where the vulnerabilities exist, and they can be many.
A lot of food processing manufacturers don't practice rigid biosecurity.
RAND Corporation terrorism analyst Peter Chalk says many food companies fail to take even the most basic precaution. Owners don't padlock warehouses, there's insufficient surveillance, and they hire a lot of transient workers, rarely doing a background check.
So actually introducing a contaminant, salmonella, botulism, mercury into the food chain would not be particularly difficult.
But Chalk says even though these weak links are present, they haven't really been tested. The last big bioterror attack happened in 1984 in The Dalles, Oregon. Cult members infected salad bars with salmonella. More than 700 people were sickened. Since then, the American food system has grappled more with unintentional outbreaks, like the listeria-laden cantaloupe, which killed 33 people in 2011. Chalk says the vulnerabilities go way beyond what's covered under the FDA proposal. Producers could be at risk as well. It'd be easy to deal a devastating blow to the country's livestock with a virus in a vial, in another type of threat called agroterrorism.
And the idea here being that if you could introduce a disease agent such as foot and mouth disease, there would be an immediate embargo on all U.S. exports of beef, and that would have reverberations throughout the economy.
To the tune of billions of dollars, a risk assessment report of a planned Kansas biosecurity laboratory showed that if a pathogen like foot and mouth disease escaped, total damage could be upwards of $50 billion, with trade cut off and consumer demand lessened. When U.S. troops raided an al-Qaeda storehouse in Afghanistan in 2002, they found documents detailing ways to taint the American food supply, with big economic repercussions. Still, no attack has materialized in the 12 years since then. Keith Rohr is Colorado's state veterinarian. He says few livestock owners consider their operations targets of terrorism, and that could leave them vulnerable.
Agriculture is critical infrastructure in our country. How would we eradicate the disease? We don't know. We have plans. We know there are steps we would take. Do we know exactly what those would be? No, we don't.
And it's those kinds of questions the FDA is hoping its new rulemaking will spur the food industry to consider. Because while you can't eliminate all risk of terrorism in the food system, government regulators are prodding businesses to create a plan in case Gotham-like fiction turns into reality. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Next week, we examine the potential impact of the FDA's food security regulations on the dairy industry, which is considered the most vulnerable to attack. Lots of cultures throughout history have corned beef as a way to preserve it. But in North America, we most associate it with Irish-American food traditions, and specifically St. Patrick's Day. It's usually made with brisket or beef round, but hey, why do it the traditional way when you can mix things up this year? That's what Chef Seth Elger is thinking.
So we have a fresh local cow tongue in corning spice. So it's pickling so that we can go on to make corned beef Saturday for our special on Sunday, which is going to be a corned beef and cabbage terrine.
Elger is the executive chef and general manager at No Coast. Sure enough, you can see the tongues floating in a big container of brine.
Corning uses pickling spices, so we're talking peppercorns, mustard seed, clove, allspice berries, bay leaves. It's got a lot of garlic, some ginger in there as well. So these very, very strong flavors help overcome some of those strong associations people have with a muscle cut like tongue.
He soaked them in salt water for a couple hours before submerging them in the brine. They'll be in here for about 5 days, then Elgar will cook the tongue in a fresh batch of brine before making the terrine. The finished product will be similar to a pâté, but held together with gelatin.
So with this particular preparation, what we're doing is taking our terrine mold here and lining it with blanched Savoy cabbage leaves, and then filling it with a smoked turkey aspic. Aspic is a homemade stock that's been set with gelatin to be thicker so that it holds together. And we'll float in purple potatoes, a little bit of onion, some herbs, and then put the finished corned beef through the center.
Is this cheaper?
Actually, to get good quality tongue, you're going to pay as much as what you would for something like Eye of Round. So it's really just, if you want that particular cut, you're going to pay the same high $2, low $3 per pound.
Are people going to be turned off by tongue?
We've run tongue several times here, including in our homemade head cheese. We also have run a smoked tongue special as well. And we get away with quite a bit of the offal, as it were. I believe from a sustainability standpoint, you have to be willing to use the whole animal. And we set out to set that example.
And how many other places in town are going to be serving cow tongue for St. Patrick's Day?
Probably none.
Playful take on corned beef with Chef Seth Elgar. He runs No Coast, Bloomington's Raw Bar. If you've been inspired to whip up some St. Patrick's Day corned beef, he has a tip. Cut your brisket into smaller pieces. Then you can get away with brining it for 3 to 4 days instead. More tips at eartheats.org. Here's a more traditional take on corned beef with Chef Daniel Orr. He's using local grass-fed beef from Fiedler Farms in Rome, Indiana. First order of business, making the corning paste. No, there are no kernels of corn in here. The name refers to the corns of salt and pepper used in preserving the meat.
So it has some fennel seeds, we have some cumin seeds, some allspice, and allspice is a little bit bigger berry, so we crush that with the back of a knife to split it up, and that will release the essential oils and bring out that flavor. And then I'm going to add about a half cup of salt. All right, I'm going to add some wet ingredients to this. Okay, I'm going to add some white wine. I've got some white wine vinegar. I'm going to add some Dijon mustard. And this is going to make a nice paste. Okay, and then we're going to add some fresh thyme leaves, which I'm just going to kind of scrape off the stems, but throw the whole stems in there. Okay, and then if you can find it, you can add some pink salt. And pink salt is what's going to keep the beef a little bit pink when you cut into it.
You'll mix all that together into a gloppy paste, really get in there with your hands, and then lather it onto the beef.
And we're going to let that sit for about 4 to 5 days, or even up to a week and a half, 2 weeks. The spices and the salt will work its way into the meat, and it will actually release some of the moisture, dry the beef out a little bit, and that's how the preserving goes. It's, you know, anytime you have moisture, that's where spoilage can take place. So when you take the moisture out by salting or drying, then you're going to have a product that lasts longer. And then what I'll do is every day or two, I'll turn it over and, you know, let it all sit down into the brine. So I want to keep mixing it and turning the meat so it gets evenly spiced. Once you take the corned beef out of the brine, you put it in cold water, bring it to a boil, and you add some of the juice that comes out as it sits, and that's going to give your liquid a really nice flavor. You cook the corned beef until it's tender. It probably will take about 2.5 hours, and you just want to be able to stick a fork into it, and it should be really, really tender. And then you take all your vegetables and you put them right in that same broth, so when you're cooking them, they're going to absorb the flavor of the corned beef, and then serve it on a big rustic platter. I like to accompany it with some freshly grated horseradish, some really nice pungent mustard, crusty Irish soda bread, and you've got yourself a wonderful St. Patrick's Day meal.
Didn't catch all that? Follow the recipe, step by step, on our website. We also have a guide to Irish whiskeys. And if you're curious to hear more about that local beef and farmer Jim Fiedler, we've got a great interview with him online as well. So much happening at eartheats.org. Coming up, soybeans, brown rice, barley, and millet all rolled into one. It's tempeh.
It's kind of a stretch for most people to think, wow, you know, that's really what I want in my life is a brick of grains. But I found a way to make it taste good.
He did. It is very good. Fry it up and serve it over top of some greens. How about that? Daniel Orr continues to work his magic in the kitchen in the second half of the show. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right, I used to say that tofu was the scary white stuff, but I found an ingredient that is more frightening than tofu, and it's called tempeh. You know, it is a protein source made with grains. The one that I have here is a three-grain tempeh. This has the soybeans, brown rice, barley, and millet. It's kind of a stretch for most people to think, wow, you know, that's really what I want in my life is a brick of grains. But I found a way to make it taste good. Now, the thing is, I do put butter in the dish. So it's if you're trying to cut out all dairy, it may not work for you, but you could try it with just some olive oil. And the dish that we're going to make it into is a meunière. Meunière in French means in the style of the miller's wife. So the miller would grind flour, and then they would trade it. So the miller usually got lots of dairy in trade for grinding flour. Traditionally, like a sole meunière would be sole that was dredged in flour, cooked in butter, and then served with lemon juice. But we're going to do the same thing with the tempeh, except for we're going to add some capers and a little bit of some nice garlic. So that's really going to make it taste wonderful.
Slice the tempeh into crouton-sized pieces, heat up some oil in a pan, and once that's nice and hot, add the tempeh and watch as it crisps up.
And this is where we're going to change the texture. You can see how it's starting to brown. It's
nice and golden already.
About 30 seconds. So you really want your pan nice and hot. Flip these over. The crunch is really important to this dish. Okay, and now we're going to add the butter as the second side browns. Okay, you can see the butter starting to brown. That's very important for any meunière dish, is that the butter's browning. Okay, to that, we're going to add a little sprinkle of lemon zest, our capers, then a nice sizzle, and then finally, we're going to add some chopped parsley, a nice amount.
And sure enough, the butter's mostly soaked in.
Yeah, and we're going to, let me give it a little taste. Mm. Best tempeh ever.
He spooned this over a bed of baby spinach and arugula for a really unique and tasty salad. You could serve this with veggies and rice if you wanted. Consider this dish for maybe your next Meatless Monday dinner. Recipe at eartheats.org. Restaurants, schools, and other big buyers are looking for local food year-round, and many of them are connecting with small farms on the internet. But not all local producers are on the cutting edge or even on the power grid. Harvest Public Media's Peter Gray reports on a community of Amish in Illinois as they work out how to merge tradition with technology to sell the food they grow.
Clouds of steam billow from a straining horse's nose as dozens of Amish families rein in jet black buggies. They're at Rockholm Gardens in Arcola, Illinois. They've come from miles around to hear farmer Dave Bishop and other members of a USDA grant-funded food hub organization team.
This co-op model makes that much easier to do and much more likely to be successful.
The concept of a co-op-supplied food hub is simple. Growers join together to create the infrastructure they need to connect to big buyers, the tracking, marketing, and delivery systems, so they can sell local food at competitive wholesale prices. Restaurants, farmers markets, even a residence hall at the University of Illinois, 30 miles to the north, are clamoring for fresh products, but they need reliable delivery, and transportation is a special challenge for this horse and buggy crowd. That's why Bishop and his food hub team are working with the Amish to create a pickup and delivery route.
One truck comes to one place. All right, this creates the kind of efficiency in the system that makes it make sense. So there is no question that by forming a group or a co-op, you can accomplish a level of efficiency you just can't accomplish as individuals.
Food hubs across the country are using online ordering and communication to make local food systems affordable, but that puts the Amish, many in the Midwest, entirely off the grid at a special disadvantage. All Amish communities treat technology differently. Many have chosen to hire someone to handle their internet traffic, just as they might hire a driver for long-distance travel.
In terms of technology, the Amish make a sharp distinction between access to it and ownership of it.
Professor Donald Craybill of Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania is an expert on Old Order Amish. They're not going to use the heavy machinery modern crop farms require, so Craybill says producing local food makes sense for Amish communities that have always farmed.
It's just a perfect marriage made in Amish heaven, so to speak, between a movement among consumers as well as a very good products that are family-friendly for the Amish.
This Amish community, struggling in an area where genetically modified corn and soybeans are king, is counting on the appetite for locally grown food to secure their future on the farm. These 8-week-old goat kids have a lot to say during my tour of Amish farmer Mervyn Graber's milking barn, but he asks that I not air his voice in this story out of respect for his beliefs. He is excited about the opportunities an Amish food hub could bring to the area, even if he's not prepared to connect to the internet. Graber does have solar panels to power his phone and fax machine. If he's any example, the Amish in the Midwest will find a creative solution to get farm fresh products to hungry customers. Peter Gray, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on the issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. A recent study suggested that simply increasing access to nutritious foods in low-income areas had a negligible impact on people's fruit and veggie consumption. Researchers speculated that perhaps access to healthy foods with educational programs on how to cook with them could result in more veggies on plates. Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is taking this idea one step further in their nutrition education workshops and letting good tastes create the demand for good food. Earth Eats' Lauren Glapa has this story from a class where participants cooked with and then tasted beans and whole grains.
Yay. Welcome to beautiful beans and gorgeous grains. Titles are hard.
Well, I feel like generally as a culture we've gotten away from cooking from scratch with whole foods. Whole foods meaning sort of single ingredient items like dry beans or flour or eggs, butter, that sort of thing. And we're used to kind of pre-processed, pre-packaged meals, and those things, one, can be a lot more expensive than the whole foods, and two, a lot of the nutrients are lost, and there are a lot of additives that we are really would be better off avoiding in our diets. But people, a lot of people in our culture are not used to cooking at home. They haven't been taught those skills. They're not familiar with it. And so we try to target that audience and say, okay, it's not that hard. Let's show you how to do it. This summer and fall, we had a lot of different kinds of dry beans available. We had chickpeas, we had red beans, pinto beans, white beans, and people took them, but I'm wondering if maybe their pantries might be stocked full of them and they're not quite sure what to do with them. So I'm hoping that this is going to be the chance to sort of learn how to make something delicious with that.
So in this class, we're going to focus on cooking beans and grains, mostly.
That was Kate Young. She's the Nutrition Education Coordinator at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, an organization that offers emergency food assistance, provides access to resources to support home gardening and home cooking, and hosts 4 community gardens where people can learn and share skills about food. Their nutrition program emphasizes healthy eating on a budget and cooking from scratch. This is Derry Johnson's first class hosted by the pantry.
Well, it's a visual thing, which is really helpful. I mean, it's obviously you can go online because I go to different recipe websites and they have video tutorials. So this in a lot of way is like having a live in-person video tutorial. So it's a little more personable and like other things like that, I feel it makes you a little more accountable if you're actually here doing it and you're participating with other people. You know, it kind of, you're on your best behavior, as it were.
During the summer months, Mother Hubbard's Cupboard has a lot of fresh produce come in, but Young says that many people aren't familiar with how to cook it. So Young says the best cooking classes are the impromptu ones, where she grabs an electric skillet and starts demonstrating immediately.
It makes all the difference, and it seems to be a bit of an icebreaker, a conversation starter. People will start talking like, oh, I've had that before. My grandma used to make it, but she did it this way. And then you start sharing food stories, and then you've made a connection, and then they might ask you some more questions like, hey, I got these garbanzo beans, but I don't know what to do with them, you know. And so it's a real conversation starter, and we feel like that's kind of our best education mode is the addressing people directly in the pantry while they're choosing the foods and selecting what they want. It's a great feeling. It's feel like, yeah, they're going to go home and cook that now. And now they have more food and more sort of resources for nourishing their family.
For Earth Eats, I'm Lauren Glappa.
See photos at eartheats.org. More photos of all the cool stuff we do. That's on our Flickr page. And our email address is eartheats@gmail.com. Do let us know what you think of the program. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Tara Cobb, Seth Elger, Lauren Glappa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Kate Young, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Real food, local farms, and community. Thanks for supporting what we do. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.